And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you, along with Bonnie Berman. Good afternoon, Bonnie.
Good afternoon.
Well, it's finally over.
Yes.
Well, almost.
Almost. Florida has to be decided, but Yes.
Well, today we visit with business journalist Christia Freeland. She's the digital editor of Thomson Reuters, and she's written Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. She joins us from NPR in New York. Welcome, Christia. Thanks for coming by.
Great to be with you, although I have to say hearing the weather report made me almost want to cry.
It's just beautiful here these days, Christia.
So we've freezing rain and snow coming here, so
rejoice in
your location.
Well, we've talked and talked and talked about the 1%. Tell us about the 0.1%.
So what I really focus on in my book is talking about income inequality, but really pointing out that so much of the action, so much of where we've seen, you know, this chasm open up in society isn't even between the 1% and the 99%. It's at the very tip top of the income pyramid. It's between the 0.1% and everybody else. And it's an economic gap. You know, the distance between those people at the very top and the rest of us is as high or higher as it has been in American history. So think about that for a minute. Bigger gap than ever before. And it is increasingly, I think, a cultural and a social gap. People who are at the very top are, simply because of the nature of their business, because of the globalized economy, leading very, very different lives from the rest of us.
So is that how they differ from the elite class of the Gilded Age, or are there other ways they're different?
Yeah, I think a very big difference is globalization. So nowadays, what it takes to get to the very, very top of the income distribution is this sort of ability to surf these waves of global capital, to follow capital around the world, to understand that, and also to sort of surf the wave of the technology revolution. And what that means is, and I'm not impugning anyone's patriotism at all, but what it means is just purely in terms of economic interests, the economic interests of those at the very, very top and of the middle class back home are much more separate than they were before. So think of a Henry Ford. And Henry Ford, you know, famously believed he had to pay his workers well enough that they could afford to buy his cars. Nowadays, if you're at the very top of the income distribution, you're not so dependent on a prosperous U.S. middle class. You're looking for markets around the world. And you can see that shift a little bit in the difference between the biographies of George Romney and Mitt Romney. You know, George Romney was a guy who built cars that were principally purchased by Americans. Mitt Romney became a sort of a global financial capitalist whose job was, and an extremely successful and effective one, but whose job was much more about financial engineering, much more about looking at balance sheets and making those work, and much less about a connection to the middle class.
So these days, one isn't necessarily a big player unless you're at the billion-dollar level?
Well, some interesting research on this group is done by the wealth management firms, you know, the investment banks, for a very good reason. These are their clients, and you need to know a lot about your clients. And they define a category they call the ultra-high net worth individual. And that group is sort of variously defined, but a popular way of thinking about those people is that is people with investable assets of $30 million or more, excluding your main residence. So I think if you have $30 million to invest, you would count as an ultra-high net worth individual. What was really interesting for me in talking to these people, though, is how your sense of money really changes as you move up the income distribution, and really regardless of where you started. So one person I talked to, for example, who comes from a very modest background, his dad was a plumber, very hardworking guy, you know, a quintessential self-made guy, And he mentioned to me that some friends had asked him to offer financial advice to a couple, retired doctors. And he said to me, really with sincere concern about these people, he said, I was really worried about how tight they were going to be in their retirement. They only had $10 million of investable assets. And I was just worried about what their retirement was going to be like. Real concern he had.
That's amazing. How were you able to penetrate into this tight-knit society for your research and for this book?
Well, I guess the way all journalists do, you know, I've been a business journalist for more years than I care to admit at this point. And so I've spent a long time talking to people, talking to business people around the world. One thing that I did find also was, you know, people actually are very sensitive, particularly in America, to talking about income inequality, and in particular, talking about wealth. I talked to some people, one person who actually said, you can't even use the word rich. Rich rhymes with bitch, and it's pejorative. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that kind of direct approach, people wasn't really effective. But what I did find worked, and a way that people were happy to frame the conversation was the sort of classic, I'm not talking about myself, I'm talking about my friend. So they would say, you know, this isn't about me, but I'm happy to describe the class overall. And I'm happy to tell you, you know, what someone on my investment committee believes. It might not be my belief, but it's what other rich people, other affluent people I know believe.
Christia, with the election just over a couple of weeks ago, you had an article in the New Yorker talking about Barack Obama and his relationship with the super rich. Is he didn't give as much face time as most candidates would. Give us a thumbnail of that article.
So, yeah, the article was based on something that I had observed that, you know, a lot of people had observed, which is really the intense, ferocious, and intensely emotional hostility towards Barack Obama in the sort of business elite in general, but particularly on Wall Street. And it's really remarkable how sort of powerful and emotional that feeling was. It's particularly remarkable because a lot of Wall Street supported Obama in 2008. They liked the fact that he was a technocrat, that he too was self-made. And yet, in this election season, you had just, you know, ferocious opposition and people willing to write checks to go with that opposition. What I found really surprising, and I talk about in this piece, Joseph, is the sense of the sincere sense of victimization among these people who are, by any measure, among the most powerful people in our society. So one example is a leading hedge fund guy, someone who supported Obama in 2008, in December 2010, sent an email to his friends, and the subject line of this email was battered wives. And the battered wives to whom he refers and who he describes in the email are himself and the other Wall Street masters of the universe. And the person who is abusing them is Barack Obama. And it sort of describes in sort of vivid detail. It says, you know, he doesn't mean to hit us, but sometimes he does. And usually he only hits us in places where it doesn't show. And really sort of reflect on that for a minute. So these are among the most powerful people in our society, and their self-portrait of themselves, their vision of themselves is that they are analogous to among the weakest people in our society, women who are being physically abused by their husbands. So it doesn't, you know, a sense of victimization doesn't get more powerful than that.
That's pretty remarkable. Now that he's been reelected, do you think he'll make changes that will hurt them? Do you think they feel, these plutocrats feel threatened by him?
Well, I think that is an excellent question and one that I am trying to think about a lot today, and I've been doing some interviews, making some phone calls. I think the hope, I spoke over the past sort of 18 hours, I spoke to some of the remaining Wall Street Democrats, and their very intense hope is that Obama will do a sort of Nixon goes to China move, and that he will use this victory as an opportunity to reconcile with the super rich. And he'll say, look, guys, you know, I know you were mad at me, but I've won now, and so let's let bygones be bygones and have some sort of a concordat. Having said that, you know, I also spoke to some Democrats, not connected with business, more on the progressive wing of the party, and they said, quite predictably, they very much hope the president won't do that. And they pointed out something which I think it could be really significant, which is in contrast with 2008, you know, the president actually doesn't owe Wall Street anything. In 2008, Wall Street actually supported the president. And between 2008 and 2012, he, over the objections of many of his advisors, was very aloof towards Wall Street. He didn't do the kind of donor management, the sort of, you know, many people, including Democrats, including people in the White House, you know, despaired of the fact that Obama, you know, didn't write thank you notes. He was unable to make these big donors feel good in the way that Bill Clinton had been able to do. So he didn't do all of that, and he won anyway. And I think it will be interesting to see whether that influences his policy in any way.
We're speaking with Chrystia Freeland. She's a digital editor of Thomson Reuters, and she's written Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich, and The Fall of Everyone Else. Stay with us. We need to take a short break. Chrystia, and we'll be right back. Team Footworks invites all walkers and runners to the FedEx Waterford 5K on Friday, November 9th. The FedEx Waterford 5K is fun for all. You can rent a tent, order catering, or play in the kids' zone, then party with DJ Irie at the post-race celebration. Proceeds benefit the Miami Children's Hospital. Details at waterford5k.com to register or 305-666-RACE for information.
It's 91.3 WLRN. The WLRN Community Advisory Board holds its regularly scheduled meeting Thursday, November 8th, 12 noon at WLRN Conference Room 170, 172 Northeast 15th Street in Miami, 33132. For more information, please visit our website at WLRN.org.
It's described as an awe-inspiring orchestral tour de force. Franz Welser Most and the Cleveland Orchestra begin the new season at the Arscht Center with Mahler's Triumphant Third Symphony. Joined by mezzo-soprano Bernarda Fink, the University of Miami Frost Symphonic Women's Chorus, Women of the Master Chorale of South Florida, and Miami Children's Chorus. November 16th and 17th. Tickets at 305-949-6722 or arschtcenter.org.
We're funded by listeners like you and by the law offices of Elliott W. Rifkin, PA, located in the Dadeland area, focusing on family, real estate, and general civil matters, and proud to support the quality programming on WLRN.
And it is today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, and we're speaking with business journalist Chrystia Freeland. She's the digital editor of Thomson Reuters, and we're talking about her book, Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you're welcome. That's 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN, and also Bonnie will take your emails. That's radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org. Chrystia, you were talking about this feeling of victimization by the super rich. I remember one quote in your book where a woman was talking about, well, really, you know, 20 million is only 10 million after taxes.
Absolutely. That is a quote. And in fact, it was that conversation really which prompted me to write the book. That conversation was recounted to me, and I thought, really? Really? People are thinking that way and talking that way? Something really important and significant is going on. So, yes, I mean, I think that what is so striking, and I think that probably we haven't confronted really squarely in our politics, is the rise of the super elite and the hollowing out of the middle class are in some ways two sides of the same economic coin. So those forces of globalization, those forces of technological change are, on the one hand, creating this winner-take-all economy where, you know, people who are great at finance, people who are great at technology, people who are hardworking, also people who are lucky, but, you know, we shouldn't sort of imagine that these are some sort of, you know, Downton Abbey landed gentry. These are really hardworking, generally meritocrats, are doing extremely well. They live in a world where, you know, they can really say, you know, 20 million a year, it's only 10 after taxes. But at the same time, those very same economic forces are hollowing out the middle class in the Western industrialized countries. And that is, you know, the paradox of today's economy that I think we have to face up to much more squarely.
Do they actually feel that they're working for the greater good? I mean, some of them are. You'd agree Bill Gates is doing tremendous good in the world and others, but do they actually feel that they're working for the greater good and the best interests of the country?
Look, I am a big believer in capitalism, and I think actually, you know, I in fact covered the collapse of the Soviet Union and the collapse of communism, so I sort of feel I've experienced for myself the failure of the only alternate system. So I think, you know, all capitalists are working for prosperity, for the common good in some way. But what I think is not really, you know, fully faced by our politics overall, and particularly not fully faced by the winners of the current economic system, is the extent to which, you know, Western financial capitalism, as currently constituted, it really isn't delivering for the middle class. That's just true. That's just what we're seeing in the numbers. We've seen now in the United States for a decade a stagnation of the incomes of the middle class. That's a really big deal. And I think even as the economic recovery takes hold, and it does seem to be, we're not seeing a great recovery in middle class incomes. And that the difficulty is, you know, when you're at these sort of Olympian high altitudes of the economic distribution, I think maybe you don't really fully see that that's happening.
Christia, in the book you say we need the super elite and they need us. Explain that.
Well, I think that goes back to my point about, you know, capitalism is really the only economic system that I know of that human beings have invented that actually, you know, leads to sustained economic growth. And I think sometimes, you know, it tends to be the left that is willing to talk about income inequality and sort of confront the fact that this is happening. But the left sometimes, you know, doesn't want to face up to the other difficult reality, which is, you know, this rising income inequality is the result very often of some benign economic forces, of globalization, of technological change. I think politics is contributing to it, by the way. So instead of softening the blow of this economic transformation, what you're seeing particularly in America politics do is intensify it. So taxes actually have fallen. Unions actually have been weakened. Standards around what is acceptable CEO compensation are much different today than they were in the 50s. So, you know, having said all of that, we can't get away from the fact that, you know, we need the plutocrats. You know, you would prefer to be in a society that is generating a lot of technology billionaires rather than one that has no technology innovation whatsoever. The plutocrats, though, also need us. And there is, you know, something which is sometimes described as a sort of a John Galt movement among the plutocrats. Mm-hmm. John Galt being the hero of Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. And in that novel, he proposes, he also, by the way, maybe he's the original victimized plutocrat. And the conceit of that novel is that the plutocrats, the super elite, they are the real value creators in society, and they're being dragged down by the people who I guess Mitt Romney would call the 47%. They're being dragged down by the moochers. And so in Atlas Shrugged, what happens is all of the plutocrats, all of the super elite, they go off to their own retreat, to Galt's Gulch, and they say, okay, you guys aren't going to appreciate us. We're going to create our own paradise and see how you fare without us. The reality is that doesn't exist, right? You can only prosper, you can only become a plutocrat, you can only become super rich in a society where you live with everyone else. And, you know, one of the things I really hope that my book does is it's read by some of the plutocrats and they'll say, you know, actually, that is important. I had my favorite reaction to the book so far is a senior Goldman Sachs executive, someone who I quote in the book, sent me an email, and the subject line just said plutocrats, and I thought, oh my goodness, you know, he is going to just be yelling at me. This is going to be terrible. I was scared to open it. And he actually said that he had liked my book, and this is my favorite point. He said, you make me feel that I should probably move to Sweden.
What did he mean by
that? Even at the very top, people can have sort of their eyes opened, I hope.
So would you say that most of these plutocrats are disconnected from the reality of the other 99.9%?
Yeah, I think inevitably. And I do really want to emphasize, I don't think they want to be. You know, another person actually who I spoke to just last night in the course of talking about trying to understand how Wall Street was going to feel about an Obama victory, again said to me about my book that it made him feel he had to focus more on his own community. And it made him really see that just because of the nature of his business, which is global, he's a technology investor, he had lost touch with what was going on in his hometown, and he felt he really needed to focus more. So, yeah, I do think they lose touch. Now, I really want to be clear. I don't think that that is because they're bad people. I don't think it's a moral failing. I think that that's what would happen to any of us if, you know, we lived our lives traveling 200 days a year, which many of these people do. If, you know, of those 200 days, half of them were outside the country. It's just the nature of capitalism today. But I think it's important for society more generally, and indeed, you know, for the caring plutocrats to stop for a minute and to take a look at what is going on more broadly.
I'd like to get used to Paul Allen's plight with his 414-foot yacht with two helicopter ports, a submarine, and a swimming pool. It must be tough getting along on that.
So you're ready, Joseph, to be a plutocrat with all the victimization that goes with that?
I want to see whether money really does change anything or not.
Well, you know, the interesting thing there is, and again, I think that this is an important point and a way in which today's super rich are different from the previous one. I think, Bonnie, you raised that point a moment ago. You know, in previous times, previous elites have tended to really try to visibly separate themselves from everyone else. You know, that's the point of conspicuous consumption. And again, you know, if we think of the 19th century, particularly, you know, 18th, 19th century in Europe, you know, you could tell which class someone belonged to instantly by the way they looked. What's interesting about today's plutocracy, and I think that this is partly because of that aspect of being a working rich, is in so many ways there is this desire to sort of say, actually, we're all the same. Actually, there's an equivalence. So, you know, Bill Gates gave a speech at MIT in 2010, and one of the brave students said, you know, so, Mr. Gates, what's it like to be a billionaire? And Gates said, well, you know, it's not that different. After all, a Big Mac costs the same amount of money no matter how rich you are. And after the first few million, it doesn't really matter. So there's that sort of notion. When I interviewed Eric Schmidt, who at the time was the CEO of Google, for my book, first of all, I interviewed him in his office in Mountain View. And, you know, first of all, it was probably, you know, no bigger than the rather small sound booth that I'm sitting in here in New York. And it had equations on the whiteboard. And so I said, you know, in the way that journalists do, trying to sort of flatter and relax the person you're interviewing, I said, oh, you know, Mr. Schmidt, that's so impressive. You're still an engineer, and there you are writing equations on your whiteboard. And he said, oh, I didn't write those. Some other guys did. And it turns out, here he is, the CEO of Google, one of the great companies on earth, incredibly rich. And anyone, when he's not in his office, any of the engineers on the floor could just walk in and use his office. And he also said to me, Schmidt did, he said, you know, and in Silicon Valley, it's really not done to have a driver of your car. It's just, it's culturally taboo. You can have a private jet, though, but you can't have a driver of your car. So that's complicating, right? You know, there is this, you know, on the one hand, we're all the same. But on the other hand, you know, as you say, Joseph, it does make a pretty big difference in your life to be a billionaire.
Again, we're speaking with Christia Freeland. Christia, do you have a website associated with you and the book and or the book?
Probably the best place to go is Reuters.com. And I have an author page there, and I write a weekly column, which often touches on these issues.
And we'll also have it on the Topical Currents Facebook page, a link.
Okay.
Great. Thank you very much.
So she's written Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich, and The Fall of Everyone Else on today's Topical Currents. We need to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
It's 91.3 WLRN. Good afternoon. Peter J. in for Caroline Brader Watts. Vizcaya Museum and Gardens offers a bike tour through Coconut Grove led by eco-historian Frank Shana on Saturday, November 10th from 10 a.m. to noon. You can take a spin through leafy streets and see the area's botanical treasures, quaint architecture, and learn about the Rockland Hammock at Vizcaya. Reservations are made through History Miami only at citytours@historymiami.org or 305-375-1621.
Red Barn Theater, 319 Duval Street, presents the world premiere of the suspense murder mystery, Person of Interest, written and directed by Bob Bowersox, November 7th through the 24th. You'll witness a riveting conflict between two powerful characters and then two unexpected plot twists to keep you on the edge of your seat. Tickets available at redbarntheater.com or the box office, 305-296-9911. Brought to you in part by the Monroe County Tourist Development Council.
We're funded by listeners like you and by Field of Flowers, delivering gifts of fresh flowers from thoughtful people like you to grateful people around South Florida and the world. Orders at 896-FRESH, that's 896-FRESH, or online at fieldofflowers.com.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with business journalist Christia Freeland, and she's written Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich, and The Fall of Everyone Else. We're going to get to some of your calls in just a moment. Christia, I just wanted to ask you, is this 0.1% or the super rich a unified class, would you say, or are there schisms within the ranks?
Well, sure. There. I would put it differently. I would say less schisms. I think there are different tribes, you know. So there's definitely the technology group is distinct. That's been a very important way to join the super elite. Finance is another way, and there are some quite significant differences. Another important group is the emerging markets plutocrats. And something that's very interesting that I think is familiar for a city like London but is new for the United States is the extent to which this group of plutocrats is becoming really global, and you're seeing more and more of the plutocrats who made their fortunes in Russia, in India, in Latin America, deciding to live part of their lives in the United States and starting to shape the culture and the politics here.
Let's take a phone call or two. We've got listener Philippe in Dania Beach. Hi.
Hey, this is Steve. How are you?
Hi.
We do a lot of graphics for some high-end clients, and something interesting. We did a poster a couple weeks ago for the Lamborghini dealer, and it was a lease on a Lamborghini, and for like $2,500 a month with $18,000 down, they put it up in the Aventura Mall on a Friday, and by Monday they sold two cars. And I have a friend also that works in a motorhome dealership, and he told me they had 14 deposits for some $1.5 million motorhomes if Romney won the election, only if he won. Hmm. If not, they were going to be canceled.
Well, not quite in the class of Paul Allen. Christian,
not quite that.
No, but that no, Philippe, you know, that's very interesting. And one of the things, you know, which I found in my reporting for my book, which was really fascinating, was, you know, looking at the research reports done by investment banks. And, you know, one conclusion that you saw echoed by quite a few reports, and this was not meant as social commentary or political commentary, this was purely, you know, objective investment advice, was research analysts noticing that you were seeing this huge split in the income in the U.S. economy, in the global economy, and advising clients in their personal portfolios to take advantage of that. One of the investment analysts calls this the plutonomy theory of investing. And his suggestion is that what you should therefore do is focus your investments either on companies that cater to those at the very, very top. You know, as Philippe was saying, you know, the guys who are producing the Lamborghinis, the $1.5 million mobile home or motorhomes. And at the same time, focus on the companies that serve people at the very, very, at maybe not the very, very bottom, but, you know, towards the bottom, the Walmarts. And what you should avoid is the companies in the middle, because it's companies in the middle serving the middle class that are going to suffer as the incomes of the middle class suffer. So that investment thesis would seem to be borne out by your own observations, Philippe.
We have the Koch brothers, the Soros, the Bill Gates. Do most of the super elite really prefer to stay in the background and under the radar?
Well, you know what's interesting is, you know, increasingly I think what you're seeing is that the real status symbol among the super elites is not so much, you know, that yacht that you were talking about, Joseph, or the Lamborghini that Philippe was telling us about. The real status symbol, once, you know, once you're in the billionaire class, certainly is a think tank or some sort of social presence, a foundation, which you are actively involved in, which you are steering, which means that, you know, as one person said to me, it makes you more than just another rich guy in New York. And so, yes, I think that we're seeing much more engagement of the plutocrats in society, in public policy. It doesn't have to be directly partisan in the way, for example, of the Koch brothers or in the way that, you know, George Soros has been engaged. It can be more on the social end, like the work of Bill Gates. And what is really interesting is, you know, that financial muscle, that financial might really does allow you to start shaping social policy. And I think how we, you know, as non-plutocrats respond to that, it sort of tends to depend on whether you agree with the plutocrat in question or not. So if you support his aims and his public policy goals, you probably think it's a great idea. And if you don't, you probably think that involvement is not so great.
Bruce in Palmetto Bay says he enjoys your TV work. He says, do you think Mitt Romney was a good choice to run for president, and was his wealth a big problem for the common voters?
I do think not so much his wealth, but I think the whole point of view that came with his wealth. Yes, I think that definitely was a problem for the Republicans. I think it was a problem in some of the key battleground states. So the combination of, you know, Mitt Romney's opposition to the car bailout, which, by the way, I should full disclosure admit that at the time I thought it was a bad idea too. You know, his opposition to the car bailouts combined with the fact that he had made his fortune in private equity, you know, the other side of that kind of economic divide, I think that hurt him and helped the Democrats very much, particularly in Ohio. And then I think the 47% remark was really damaging, and I think it was damaging because it was what one of the journalists I really admire, Michael Kinsley, has defined as a gaffe being when you tell the truth but you weren't supposed to. I think that 47% remark by Governor Romney reflected his real views. I certainly have heard variations on that theme from a lot of the super rich who I interviewed. And I think for a lot of Americans, it sort of suggested a disdain for people in the bottom half of society, for people who actually don't see themselves as moochers, but who believe that sometimes in their lives they've maybe needed government support and are grateful to have had it.
Tell us about Google's famous Zeitgeist conference where you've been a speaker. What's the ambiance there?
That was one of the moments, the Zeitgeist conferences, which are actually incredibly well done, as is so much that Google does. That was one of the experiences that made me believe that, you know, what the super elite call, and what is, you know, now called thought leadership, having your own foundation, sort of shaping the world of ideas, was increasingly important for the plutocrats and more important than other forms of conspicuous consumption. So Google, like some of the other top companies in the world, sponsors hosts a couple of annual conferences, one in Europe, one in the U.S. They call Zeitgeist. So, you know, there you go. That immediately puts you in that realm of ideas. And really what they try to do is bring together some of their senior executives, a lot of their clients, and then expose them to, you know, as defined by them, some of the top thinkers, maybe some top political leaders in the world. And you do see one of the plutocrats describe for me, you know, what is this, what is the new social circuit of the global plutocracy? And it, a lot of it is about going to these, you know, conferences of ideas. So Davos, that annual gathering in Switzerland, held by the World Economic Forum at the end of January, that's definitely on the circuit. The Aspen Ideas Festival on the circuit for a lot of people. They do go for a few events that are more about pure fun. The Chelsea Flower Show in London is on the calendar for a lot of people. But there is, you know, increasingly this sort of set of events around the world that the plutocrats go to, that they invite their clients to. And that is a way that you see them forming their own international community.
We're speaking with business journalist Chrystia Freeland about her book, Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else. We'll take a short break and be back with more.
It's Harvest Drive's 20th anniversary of Children Helping Children. Harvest Drive provides families a week's groceries plus fixings for Thanksgiving dinner. Drop-off locations throughout Broward County are at harvestdriveflorida.com. Brought to you by the Children's Services Council of Broward County. It's 91.3 WLRN. More of Topical Currents coming up in just a moment.
The movie Bag It, Is Your Life Too Plastic? Follows Jeb Barrier as he embarks on a quest to figure out where plastic bags come from, where they end up, and what they're doing in our environment. It's a humorous look at a serious topic. You can see the film and meet the filmmaker and actor following the screening of Bag It, Is Your Life Too Plastic? Thursday, November 8th at the Miramar Cultural Center. Tickets and information at 954-602-4500 or miramarculturalcenter.org.
From the authors of the smash hit Death and Harry Houdini comes a fresh new rock musical. The critics call it an all-out war of the sexes, hot-blooded and exciting. You may not want to miss the breakthrough musical that is cranking up the volume, Girls vs. Boys. Seating is limited in the intimate Carnival Studio Theater. Info at archcenter.org.
and welcome back to Wednesday's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with Christia Freeland, and she's a business journalist. She's written Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich, and The Fall of Everyone Else. Christia, you said you were opposed to the auto industry bailout at the time. Why was that?
I was mistaken. I thought that it wasn't going to work. And I think with hindsight, it was one of the really smart decisions that the Obama administration took.
Were you opposed to the financial bailout as well?
No.
Okay.
No, and the reason that I thought that was a good idea at the time was I wasn't sure it was going to work, but it was obvious to me that the U.S. economy and the world economy actually could not survive if Wall Street was not kept afloat. What I do think was a mistake there, and again, this is a mistake that has become more apparent in hindsight, but the genesis of that mistake is very much connected with, you know, the rise of the global super elite and their sort of ideological power, is that there weren't more strings attached. So one of the ironies of Wall Street's hostility to President Obama, one of the ironies of the profound sense of victimization that you hear among financiers is actually they were the recipients of, you know, the single greatest form of government largesse we've seen in a generation. And why weren't they more grateful? And I think the reason they aren't more grateful is because that, you know, the strings attached, the quid pro quo, wasn't as explicit as it could and should have been. You know, the reality that this was a perfect example of the plutocrats really needing the rest of society, really needing government. And it wasn't just the big banks that were bailed out that needed the government. The whole financial services industry could have collapsed had the government not put that safety net in place. And I think that the government should absolutely have made that connection much more explicit, both to financial services people and to the rest of society. And by the way, had the government done that then, it might have been easier to put in place the sorts of tougher regulation that I think we absolutely need.
Why is it that Democrats and Republicans alike are still in favor of keeping many aspects of the current tax code intact?
Particularly the tax breaks for people at the very top?
Yes.
Well, you know, this is one of the great mysteries. And to me, one of the greatest political mysteries is how hard it has been to revoke a particular tax break, which is the treatment of carried interest. And this is a tax break which is particularly beneficial to people in the private equity business, and allows people who are, you know, active in private equity to have what I think most of us would judge to be their income treated as a capital gain and taxed at that level. This is the tax break, which is very much the reason that, you know, as we learned, someone like Mitt Romney pays taxes at a rate of 14%. And it's kind of amazing because it's, you know, although when I talk to people actually in the private equity business, they will defend to their dying breath the correctness of the way that carried interest is currently taxed. I haven't met a single person in the industry itself who will admit that actually, you know, this is just a really lucky break and we're so delighted to be enjoying it. But even people who are extremely friendly to capitalism but not in the industry itself think that, you know, it just shouldn't be there. It's a loophole that should be closed. And one example that I'll give you is Mike Bloomberg, you know, himself a plutocrat, himself a full-throated defender of Wall Street, of capitalism. And he has said, you know, come on, guys, this carried interest loophole really, really needs to be closed. And despite that, despite the fact that, let's remember, Barack Obama has been president for 4 years, that loophole hasn't been closed. I think that says something to you about the power of a very wealthy lobby group, which is laser focused on a particular issue that maybe the rest of us aren't aware of, don't care that much about.
David in North Miami Beach says communism lost, but corporatism and democratic socialism still rival democratic capitalism. Reagan's 50% income tax rate on corporations and the rich would solve a lot.
Look, I do think that one thing that we've forgotten, and by we, I would say particularly in America, and I guess that doesn't fully include me because I'm Canadian, but one of the striking things about the American political discourse is the extent to which people have forgotten how low taxes in the United States are today compared to historical levels. You know, so David cites the Reagan era. And again, let's remember, Reagan was a Republican. You can look not that far back to the 1950s, again, not, you know, seen as an era of socialism in the United States, when the top marginal tax rate was above 90%. Think about that, above 90%. And Obama has been criticized, has been accused himself of being a socialist, simply for suggesting that the Bush era tax cuts for those at the very top should lapse, and that maybe we should go back to Clinton era rates. So, you know, I think David makes a very good point when he says, you know, our historical memory of what are acceptable taxes, especially at the very top in the United States, is very, very short indeed. And this notion that taxes are unacceptably, unbearably, ahistorically high is simply wrong. Now, you can have another debate about, you know, do you believe in an absolutely minimal state with absolutely minimal taxes? And I think that's an intellectually legitimate debate to have. But to pretend that America is groaning under a tax burden greater than it ever has before is simply false.
How about today's plutocrats compared to the hereditary elite, the Mayflower descendants, the Esters, the Cabots, and so on?
Well, you know, the historical perspective is really interesting. I'll start with the Mayflower. And one of the things that when you look into American history, particularly in the era of the Founding Fathers, is you discover that both by accounts of people living in that time and also when economic historians have gone back and tried to look at the data, America actually was one of the most egalitarian societies in the world that we knew about. Now, there's a very big sort of asterisk there, which is it was a society with slave owning. But actually, even when you include in pure income the income of slaves, America was much more egalitarian in those days than Europe was. That was something that Americans were proud of. Thomas Jefferson bragged about it. He bragged, actually, we have almost no people who are truly rich. He bragged that we have almost no people who can live purely off of their wealth. Everybody has to work, and the gap between the people at the top and the people at the bottom is much smaller than it was in Europe. And that is, I think, a really important historical fact to bear in mind, that America at the moment of its founding was really effectively the Sweden of its time. If you move further ahead in history, I think today's plutocrats have a lot in common with the robber barons. You know, that period, this sort of period of very vigorous, very turbulent capitalism in the 19th century had a lot resembled in many ways what we're living through today. And you had similarly, you know, people who were aggressive, who were able to take risk, who were lucky in the right place at the right time, rising very, very fast to the top and a gap opening up between them and everybody else. You then had a period of that initial wealth becoming inherited wealth. And today, again, you know, we're back much more to an age of what the Berkeley economist Emmanuel Saez describes as the working rich. That you know, of course, if you want to become a plutocrat, it helps to be born into an affluent middle-class family. Choose your parents well. but what is interesting is, you know, the people at the very, very top tend to have made their specific fortune themselves. And again, Mitt Romney is a good example. So he was absolutely born in extremely comfortable circumstances, but he didn't inherit bank capital.
Well, we certainly want to thank you. It's been a really intriguing hour with business journalist Chrystia Freeland. She's the author of Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich. in the fall of everyone else. Thank you very much, Christia.
Thank you, Joseph. Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you, callers. Thank you.
I really enjoyed the conversation.
And Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ive. Technical direction today from Peter J. Paul Leary gives production assistance and online help. We have free audio archives and downloads of past programs at our website. That's WLRN.org. And find author and book links plus much, much more at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow, we get insight on how we can stay away from anger in a stressful job atmosphere. Also, Linda Gassenheimer and Florida cuisine, beyond stone crabs and the ubiquitous key lime pie. And to the calendar, on this day in 185, 207 years ago, the Lewis and Clark expedition reaches the Pacific Ocean near what is now Astoria, Oregon. They return to St. Louis via the Missouri River in September of 186. And on this day in 1900, 112 years ago, the birth of Nazi SS and Gestapo leader Heinrich Himmler near Munich. Before joining the Nazis, he was a chicken farmer. And one more. On this day in 1987, 25 years ago, appellate judge Douglas H. Ginsburg asked President Reagan to withdraw his nomination to the Supreme Court after a clamor ensued when it was revealed he was an occasional pot smoker in the 1960s and 70s. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. We leave with a thought from Himmler, who swallowed cyanide before testifying at Nuremberg. Quote, "The best political weapon is the weapon of terror. Cruelty commands respect. Men may hate us, but we don't ask for love, only for their fear." This is Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation.
It's 91.